Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Wall Street firms are expected to pay a record $140 billion in bonuses this year. President Obama's senior advisor David Axelrod called the bonuses offensive. Joining me to talk about where the economy is today, where it might be headed, and why some CEOs are receiving exorbitant pay after being bailed out by the government, John Harwood, with the New York Times and CNBC, former Congressional Budget Office Director and McCain Presidential Campaign Advisor, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, and Lawrence Michel. He's president of the Economic Policy Institute. We'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. And joining us now is Jared Bernstein. He's chief economist and economic policy advisor for Vice President Joe Biden. He's executive director of the Vice President's Middle Class Task Force. Good morning to you, Jared.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to hear your voice again. Tell us how many jobs have been created thus far by the stimulus plan.
About 1 million jobs have been created or saved. And saved is important, too. Think about school teachers, for example, who are dependent on public sector budgets at the state and local level. These are important jobs, and there's a lot of students that are sitting in classrooms that are half as large as they otherwise would have been because hundreds of thousands of teachers have had their jobs saved through fiscal relief through the Recovery Act.
On the other hand, speaking about teachers' jobs, here in Washington, you've had hundreds laid off.
Yeah. I think that gets to the heart of almost any jobs discussion you're going to have about the Recovery Act. We're obviously looking at a deficit in the labor market that goes far beyond, I believe, what any conceivable Keynesian stimulus could have offset. You're talking about a gap in terms of output or GDP, literally trillions of dollars. You're talking about a job market that has shed well over 7 million jobs thus far. The Recovery Act is the most aggressive, far-reaching stimulus in the history of this nation designed to offset part of that pain. But there's no conceivable plan that could have been done in a matter of either politically or fiscally responsible that could have fully offset that gap.
Now, didn't the administration say that the stimulus would create or save 3.5 million jobs?
Yes, thank you. That's an important point. The 1 million created or saved thus far is exactly that. It's thus far. The stimulus is a bit of a time release plan that continues to operate until well into next year. At this point, about 40%, somewhere around $340 billion or so, of the stimulus plan has been put to work in the economy. That means there's a lot more to come, and we're on track to hit that 3.5 million jobs saved or created by later next year.
Are you actually considering a second stimulus package?
No, as I said, this one is not even half obligated or at work in the economy. There's a lot more to come. We have to oversee that. We also have some very important fiscal considerations to take into account. And the point of a stimulus is to get into the system, ramp up, and then get out as the private sector comes in to fill that missing demand. Now, implicit in your question is the very correct notion that we don't want to leave any kind of a Keynesian air pocket in there. You know, you can't, I get worried about, I can go a little crazy with metaphors here, you can't pull the jumper cables off too soon. And so we have to be mindful of that dynamic, but no on a second stimulus.
Jared, there's been a lot of attention focused on this $250 that you're going to pay to senior citizens. How do you see that actually helping the economy? And I realize you're paying it because there's not going to be a cost of living addition to Social Security. But why $250? And where is that money going to come from?
Well, the $250 is actually an extension of a component of the stimulus plan that paid out this year. This $250 is a repeat of that for next year. And you're right, it's partially motivated because inflation has been negative, and therefore there's no COLA to Social Security. Still, we know that seniors are hurting. This also goes to disabled persons and veterans. Obviously, it's still a very tough economy out there in perspective of the job market. I know you got Dr. Larry Michel there on the panel, and he talks very eloquently about that issue. So we think that this is going to help offset some of that pain. If you look at this in terms of the average Social Security benefit, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2%. So it works a lot like a COLA. Now, you asked who's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Who is going to pay for it?
The question of this stimulus, when you think about stimulus, and again, I know your panelists can take listeners through this as well. When you think about stimulus, you have to think about offsetting the stimulus by raising taxes to pay for it does precisely that. It cancels out its stimulative effect on the economy. So we have to be mindful of not offsetting the very important stimulative impact on the economy. If you wanted to, say, pay for components of the stimulus, one of the things you'd have to consider doing is raising taxes. And there's no way we're going to raise taxes on anyone. Obviously, we're not going to do that on the middle class no matter what, but on anyone in the context of of the deepest recession since the Great Depression.
So you still haven't explained to me how you're paying for this $250 person.
It's a good question. And as Peter Orszag, budget director, said the other day, in our 2011 budget, we're going to have lots of new pay-fors that will explain how we achieve our goal of bringing the deficit back down into a sustainable range over the budget window. We hope to get the budget deficit down to about half of what we inherited when we got here. And that's going to have to be done. I mean, this is not rocket science. It's going to have to be done by implementing some very tough measures to get that deficit back in line.
Got to tell you, Jared, when you're talking to someone like me, it does sound like rocket science in the sense that it's not clear. And if it's not clear to me, my guess is it's not clear to a lot of people.
Well, I think that's fair, Diane, and I think you have to be mindful of, and you know this very well, and we live in a very, very political town, political environment, and it's not for me to get out in front of our 2011 budget plans and explain precisely what steps we're going to take. We had very extensive deficit reduction in our 2010 budget. We fully paid for, and I think in many ways this is the most important, healthcare reform with a reserve fund that was completely paid for. And in fact, if you look at the healthcare plans that are coming across the process right now, they don't add to the deficit. That's the president's fundamental rule here. And by the way, let me make this point, and it's a very important one. The $250 that we're talking about for seniors, that's probably going to amount to somewhere in the $13 billion range. That's not small change, don't get me wrong. That needs to be paid for in a climate where we're trying to bring the deficit back down to sustainable levels. No question about it. But that is not That is not the long-term fiscal challenge that we face by any stretch of the imagination. The long-term fiscal challenge that we face is a health care challenge. And by reforming the health care system without adding a dime to the deficit, that's the serious fiscal responsibility that this administration is undertaking.
Jared Bernstein, he's chief economic policy advisor for Vice President Joseph Biden. Thanks for joining us, Jared.
My pleasure.
And turning to you now, Lawrence Mischel, 3.5 million jobs out of this stimulus package.
Well, I think Jared is actually understating the job benefit of the recovery package so far. If you look at the estimates of people like Goldman Sachs, Economy.com, other forecasters, they're saying that in the spring and summer, the recovery package was raising GDP at a 3% annual rate relative to what it would be otherwise. We saw the economy decline by 1% in the spring. It would have declined by 4%. You translate that to jobs, it's roughly, at least 200,000 a month. If that's true, and we're at least 6 months into this process, then it's around 1.2 million jobs that have already been created or saved. So I think it's been a very bold and effective plan. I think what Jared said was absolutely right, that we were in a huge, huge hole, so huge that, it's really hard to imagine any policy being able to offset that. What I was disappointed about, and my former colleague Jared saying, that no more needs to be done, because in fact, we are still seeing rising unemployment. We will. It's not the fault of the administration. I think it's something we have to do. And I think we should be forthright that to do so, we're going to have to be willing to tolerate a higher deficit this year and next, not long term into the future, to do things that are going to inject more expenditure in the economy and create more jobs.
Lawrence Mischel, he's president of the Economic Policy Institute. When we come back, you'll hear from our other guests as well, John Harwood of the New York Times and CNBC, and Douglas Holtz Aiken. He served as chief economist to President George W. Bush. Stay with us. We're back. John Harwood of the New York Times. I'm still hung up on this $250 per person to seniors who currently receive Social Security. Doesn't Jared Bernstein have to say we're going to raise the deficit?
Yes, but he doesn't want to say that because he doesn't want to give ammunition to people like Doug sitting next to me who, to use Jared's metaphor, would like to get rid of the ripcord on Jared's parachute. But look, they don't want to say they're increasing the deficit. They also don't want to say that they're considering additional steps. And I think Larry Mischel, I understand why he's trying to call his former colleague on saying he's not for additional stimulus. But I think the administration is considering other steps. They're just not going to call them stimulus because they know that that idea has been discredited in the American public.
So what's the language they're going to use?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do, but I think it is possible that they are going to get behind some sort of a tax credit to spur hiring, which Barack Obama supported in the campaign. The idea was discarded earlier this year in Congress out of concerns that employers would game the system. But a lot of smart people, including Larry, are working on refinements of that idea and trying to figure out whether, in fact, there are cost-effective ways of spurring hiring, since people like Mark Zandi say the unemployment rate, now 9.8, is headed up to 10.5%.
Exactly. Doug Holtzakin, New York, the Wall Street Journal has a piece this morning saying, though the depression or recession seems to be drawing to a close, employers are cutting pay, they're increasing the workers' share of health care costs, or reducing the employer contribution to retirement plans. So no matter, you've got Wall Street booming, you've got workers still hurting.
I'd be careful about declaring this recession over too quickly, quite frankly. There's an enormous amount of stress on the household sector. That's about two-thirds of spending in our economy typically. We still have home prices, which are way down. A lot of foreclosures are coming. We see credit card debt out there. And even for those who have a job and are fortunate enough to have held on, we're not seeing rises in pay that look like the foundation of a real sustained long-term spending. So I think we're going to need to see better performance out of the business sector and our exports to get a foundation for a sustainable recovery. And we need to see that before we declare victory.
How do you measure a recession? How do you measure the end of a recession? Larry Michel.
Well, I think this is a topic where economists and the business press totally talk past the normal human being. So let me just say what economists say and what any normal human being would consider the end of a recession. Economists look at the output of the economy, and when the output of the economy stops shrinking, they call it the end of the recession. Now, in fact, when the economy starts growing, output starts growing, you could still have job losses. You will still have job losses. You can still have rising unemployment. We expect unemployment to rise for another year. But it is true that this third quarter, the basically July, August, September, is going to see the economy actually growing rather than shrinking. I think that Doug is right. There's no reason to be calm about this, because the only reason why the economy is actually not shrinking and growing, in my view, is because of the recovery package. It's not the underlying strength of the private sector. We have to get that going. That, I think, raises the questions of how much longer and what do you need to do to actually strengthen the growth so that we can get faster job creation, as well as, you know, then reasonable questions about when you withdraw government support for the economy as we have it now, both the Federal Reserve Board and the federal government.
John Harwood.
If I could just ask my friend Doug, I thought I heard him making an argument there for additional stimulus of some kind because he thinks the economy is weak, and maybe also, in light of his comments about exports, for continued decline in the value of the dollar. Is that what you think ought to happen, both of those things?
I'm not in favor of additional stimulus. I'm just pointing out the reality that this package we have so far is a very inefficient package, and it's done as well as it's going to do. I mean, this is a two-year package. That means about 12% goes out every quarter. We're on track to get that out. And so whatever you want to attribute to the stimulus package has happened, and it's not going to
so what would you do
any
to
better
address
to
the
double
weakness
down
that you referred to?
There are some things you simply cannot fix, and you're not going to replace with any Keynesian stimulus a decline of $12 trillion in household wealth. It can't be done. We need to acknowledge that. And to run up an enormous debt in a futile attempt to get near-term results, I think, is a very mistaken policy. We saw in the 60s and 70s this pattern precisely, a continued effort to use taxes and spending to manage the economy, an effort by the Federal Reserve to only worry about unemployment. And what did we get? We got chronically high unemployment and high inflation. And we have forgotten that lesson. We're not going to micromanage this economy with another stimulus package and get instant results.
Larry Michel.
Well, what Doug is saying essentially is the recovery package is doing a reasonable job. Whatever it's doing going forward is having its effect, but that we're going to see disappointing outcomes in the future. But that we have to just tough it out. I'm one that doesn't believe we just have to tough it out, because I think the toughing it out means, in my view, we're going to see black child poverty exceed 50%. We're going to see substantial income losses for the next 3 to 5 years. That's really horrible, and I think it'll actually hurt future economic growth if we don't do anything.
Okay. And Diane, here you're seeing the dilemma facing Democratic politicians. Let's say Doug is right, and that additional stimulus would not actually make much of a difference, and we do have to tough it out. That's not an easy argument to make if you're a Democratic member of Congress running in 2010 and you see unemployment spiking over 10%. You say, sorry, voters, we're just going to have to sit tight and wait for this thing to happen. That is why you're getting pressure among Democrats to look to people like Larry for ideas.
All right. So what difference does this 10,000-point Dow Jones average make in the minds of people who are looking at, working with the economy, Doug?
Well, the rebound in the stock market is good news to the extent that it allows households to have a better retirement prospect than they did when the market was deeply depressed, have the capacity to look forward to sending their kids to college, whatever their savings goals might have been. That's the good news. But that's about as far as it goes, quite frankly. It doesn't signal recovery in the economy itself, per se. You know, I think the thing to remember is by picking a package which is so large but inefficient in job creation, the administration has tied its hands. It now doesn't have the flexibility that it would like to have to take additional measures. And you know, I think for the listeners, you know, sort of wondering about this, you know, how many jobs are created debate, remember, you're never going to know. We're never going to see the world that would have been without the stimulus package, so you'll never be able to actually compare between this one and the one where we didn't do the stimulus. So we're relying entirely on models, where these electronic models that the forecasters use. Those same models said that with the stimulus, we'd never get unemployment above 8%. The models are badly flawed in that regard. And so I think if you look in the data, you look at the 30,000 jobs that the administration posted on recovery.gov, $16 billion gets you 30,000 jobs. That's $500,000 a job. It's not a very efficient package.
But Doug, in fairness, didn't the models that said unemployment was going to go over 8%, weren't those calculated before everybody knew what the fourth quarter results were going to be, and therefore, you know, the fourth quarter was much worse, therefore unemployment's higher?
It's not just this one episode. I mean, these are the same models that the Bush administration, for example, used when it talked about stimulus packages. The models are fundamentally too responsive to Federal Reserve and government policy.
Larry, Michelle.
Well, I think with the models, I agree with Doug that the models are wrong, but the models do two things. They tell you what a policy is going to do, the impact on an underlying economy, and then there's the projection of the underlying economy. What was very wrong was the underlying economy, and that is that they said that the unemployment was going to be something like 6.9% in the early 2009. In fact, by March, it was already 8.5%. So it's not anything wrong about the recovery package that the administration said that unemployment was going to not top 8%. It was 8.5% before the recovery package ever hit the streets.
You know, I got to tell you, I get awfully weary with models and representations. Here's an email from Julie who says, as one of those millions of Americans still unemployed, I feel the recession is still very real. That won't change for me until I find work, no matter how high the Dow gets. John.
Well, that's exactly right. And millions of listeners are listening to this show right now and saying, model this. You know, look at my life and what's happening to my job prospects and those in my families. As Doug said, there is some good news. As stock values rise, people can feel a little bit better about whatever their holdings are in college funds and retirement funds and that sort of thing. But it's pretty tough, and most people tend to view the health of the economy right now through the prism of the employment situation.
And what about the wage inequality in America, Larry?
Well, I think one of the reasons we got into this mess is because we had growth based on people going into debt and asset bubbles. We need to be able to restore some growth based on people earning a good wage and being able to spend from that. And I think to do that, we're going to have to end this dramatic inequality that's been going on for 30 years, but that was never stronger, at least in the wage market the last recovery was pretty much really the worst disparity between people's growing wages and what the productivity that they actually produced.
And John, you, I gather, spoke with Larry Summers on executive pay. Tell me what he said.
Well, he was defending the financial regulation proposal that the administration has put forward that is now beginning to work its way through the Congress. It's happening at a time when Wall Street is on track to award a record amount of bonuses, which is strikingly fast after so much of Wall Street was bailed out. At the same time, the administration's proposal is not to have dollar limits on compensation like some European governments have favored, but rather to try to shift the incentives in the way compensation is structured, give shareholders a greater say and a voice in what executives are paid. But they're not putting caps on, and that's a way the administration is trying to kind of thread the needle between a market-based system and this populist anger that you heard administration officials speaking to on the Sunday shows over the weekend.
That was certainly David Axelrod
and
calling.
And Valerie Jarrett as well.
And Jarrett as well. I mean, they're not alone in believing that these benefits, these bonuses, are totally offensive to the American people, and yet they continue.
They do. And, you know, one of the questions that all of us have to think about is, how do you preserve what is best about the engine of capitalism while curbing things that are excessive or wrongly put together? And the administration has come up with a solution. We'll see whether it flies in Congress.
And that's John Harwood of the New York Times. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's open the phones. Let's hear what our callers have to say. 800-433-8850. First to Palm Coast, Florida. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for your show. You're a national treasure.
Thank you.
I think it's obscene that the same people whose greed caused this catastrophe are already getting these obscene bonuses. When TARP money was accepted, all bonuses should have been frozen until the money was paid back. Also, the accounting rules were changed. Assets used to be accounted for at today's market value. Then they will let them go back to estimating assets. Therefore, these figures are totally bogus. They also have Obama over a barrel, because he has to say the banks are now healthy and the economy is improving, which means that they can give themselves as much money as they like with our money.
Duck.
Well, I think that once you take government money, you are in a different world. And the fact that Wall Street doesn't understand this is indicative of a culture that has really, I think, lost track of where it is compared to America. And going forward, Wall Street's going to have to change its culture internally. And I think John said it best. The administration doesn't want to put price controls in, caps on pay figures, but it does want to put in place the kinds of market forces that rein in excess, which is to say, let's have some competition for these top jobs, make it possible for the shareholders to exercise a vote on pay, make it easier for them to get the top executives replaced where appropriate, have arm's-length compensation committees. You know, the coziness of a lot of these arrangements is what upsets people, not just the dollar figures.
John.
Could I just echo one thing the caller said? You are a national treasure.
Oh, thank you.
Look, I think that getting this right is a real challenge. And the administration is at a point of kind of exquisite cross pressures, because Barack Obama wants to be seen as a centrist, right? He's got an ambitious set of domestic proposals. You've got attacks from Republicans saying he's a far left sort of radical on economic issues. That is not how he wants to be seen. On the other hand, he realizes that many people in the country have the reaction that you had and that we've been and our caller had to the way people are compensated on Wall Street. And I think that the ultimate solution is going to be not in the details of financial regulation, but in a robust economic recovery. And the question is, when do they get one?
How effective can shareholders be? Larry.
Well, I think that's actually pretty weak, T, these governance changes. I think what we need also is a big dose of shame, which I hope the media visits upon these folks. But I think we should combine these two conversations.
They don't seem to have any.
No, you're right, right. But let's combine these two conversations about jobs, the deficits, and Wall Street. I think we need to do a lot more about jobs, and we need to spend money and drive up the deficit over the next 2 years. But I think we can pay for that by a tax on Wall Street, basically a financial transactions tax, a very small sales tax on the buying and selling of all these derivatives and swaps and exchange stocks and bonds that will actually make a package over 10 years deficit reducing. And the financial sector threw us into the recession. We now need the jobs. Why shouldn't we have a small tax on them going forward and pay for what we need to do to actually generate more jobs?
So you mean drive up the deficit in the short term, but pay for it over 10 years?
Absolutely.
Through this tax.
I think we need to have at least $500 billion more deficit in the next 2 years and pay for it. We will actually reduce the deficit over the 10-year window.
Larry Michel of the Economic Policy Institute, John Harwood of New York Times, CNBC, and Doug Holtz-Aiken, chief economist in President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. Short break. More of your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
A manifesto for slower communication. One of America's preeminent literary critics says, step away from your screen, put down the BlackBerry, and take charge of ever-accelerating forms of communication. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Doug Holtz-Aiken, I know you wanted to make a comment in response to Larry's.
Well, I think you should be careful when you talk about a tax on Wall Street as if somehow there's a pot of money on Wall Street that you're going to go and get and not touch the rest of the economy. In fact, all taxes get paid by people. Wall Street firms are going to be no different than any other firm. They're going to try to pass that tax along. And what it'll show up on as is lower returns to your IRA, to your pension, to a lot of things. So I'm skeptical that tax will actually be funded by Wall Street and thus...
What about regulation on those transactions?
We know that in both the House and the Senate, there are comprehensive regulatory initiatives. And many of them, I think, are very sensible. I mean, the notion of having exchange trades for a lot of these derivatives has always been something that made a lot of sense to me. If you think about the job picture, I think one thing it's worth mentioning is that if you're a small business in America right now, there's a lot of the Obama domestic agenda, which is actually scary and is hurting their confidence to create jobs. At the moment, they have in play a very extensive Waxman-Markey regulation bill aimed at climate change in principle, but much more intrusive than it needs to be. Healthcare reform has included mandates on employers and things that are very costly. The Employee Free Choice Act would make it easier to unionize and raise costs for employers. The trade initiatives, which are protectionist in their nature, hurt small business exporters, who are 70% of our exporters are the small businesses. We have deficits as far as the eye can see, $1 trillion under the Obama plan in 2019, raising the specter of big spikes in interest rates down the road. They could do a lot of good by simply scaling back, trying to do so much, and genuinely focusing on jobs.
But, Doug, your old buddies at the CBO say Obama's health package will save, or the Senate Finance Committee package will save money from the deficit.
It's let's be honest about that fantasy. It only balanced over 10 years because they promised they were going to cut docs 24% in 2 years.
Okay.
They're never going to do that.
I'm going to stop this right here because it's going far afield. Here's an email from Annie who says, I've yet to hear anyone say what would happen with these big bonuses if the companies had not been bailed out. Where would the bonuses have come from then? Why should any previous contracts be valid under these circumstances? Is our government that weak? I had to borrow money to pay my taxes, and it just makes me start to hate this government for using my tax money to give these greedy people bonuses. Larry.
Well, you can really understand that. This is a policy that was started in the last administration and that was inherited and continued by this administration.
How good a job can this new Pazar do?
Well, I think he can make some progress, but I think we are going to need some more kinds of regulations. And I think people are right to be angry that their money is
really
is going
furious.
To these people.
It's not just angry.
Yeah.
Furious.
I understand that totally, and I think a lot of things are going to have to be done that are going to have to rein in Wall Street. And I think some of it is these people are making money by doing zillions of trades a day, and I think a small sales tax on them that gets money is not going to be felt by the individual person who owns an IRA who most likely has less than $5,000, $20,000 in an IRA or the stock market.
Okay, Larry,
it's going to be helped by the hedge funds and all those folks.
You talked about a five-part strategy for creating and preserving jobs. Number one, you've talked about extending unemployment benefits. How far?
Well, I think we have to be able to keep that going for quite a while. Right now, there are more than six people unemployed for every job opening.
Right.
The idea that somehow people are just going to work, scurry around and find a job isn't going to happen. Providing people the unemployment insurance not only helps them as provides relief from this really horrible storm we're in, but also these are folks, when they get the money, they're going to spend it. This helps support spending in the economy. When you give money to somebody whose income is temporarily low, has been lowered, they spend it. They don't save it. That's actually good for job creation.
You're also talking about helping states to prevent massive public sector layoffs.
Yes. I think it's very important to consider more fiscal relief to state and local governments. Goldman Sachs projects that just the fact that the state governments are going to have to balance their budgets from the big hole that they're in is going to slow the economy by around 0.7% over the next year. That costs us around, somewhere between 600,000 and a million jobs.
You know, John Harwood, when Larry mentions Goldman Sachs, some people may recoil and say, why should I believe anything Goldman Sachs says anymore?
They have some great economists and have done a really great job forecasting. I think they're very separate from the others that have helped drive the economy
right,
to a
but
mess.
But listen to this caller from Akron, Ohio. Elena, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
These bonuses are described as being retainer bonuses. From the state of the economy, these people are obviously inept. Why bother retaining them?
Doug.
I have no particular quarrel with that observation. I mean, this is the
but
issue
that
faces us.
But that is the argument that's made by these big Wall Street firms for paying these bonuses, that they were contractually agreed to, that they have to retain good people.
I actually think it's right to respect contracts. I mean, I think the idea that you want to just willy-nilly start tearing up the contracts is a mistake from the larger policy perspective. But the real issue is going forward, setting in place an environment where this is not presumed to be the way you go about retaining top talent. And I find it hard to believe on the numbers that you need the dollars on the table that they're talking about simply to retain these people.
John Harwood.
Well, I agree with Doug. Let me try to state what I think would be the argument from Wall Street. And I've never worked on Wall Street, and I don't know that world very intimately at all.
I hope you don't intend to, John.
No.
Okay.
But I imagine there are some people with exceptional talent who are getting some of these bonuses and may even be earning the bonuses to the extent that people provide incentives for people to get a certain percentage of the business that they generate or the profits that they generate. The problem with that is it's kind of like a baseball team. You pay A-Rod $33 million a year, right, for the New York Yankees. But if the team doesn't win do all the rest of the people play for free? Do they give back money? Does A-Rod pay those people? You have high-achieving members of these firms, but you've also got people who've done badly. They got to get paid somehow too, and so it's hard to justify the high-end payouts if you're not dealing with the low-end.
Larry, Michelle, you want to weigh in?
Well, what's outrageous to me is that these people made a gazillion dollars in the upturn. And then when they threw the world into a global recession, none of that money came back, right? The firms got bankrupted, went out of business, taxpayers had to bail them out, and then they want to return to business as usual. And I think any politician that goes along with that is going to pay a big price.
The distinction, by the way, is I mentioned the A-Rod thing. When you root for the Yankees, if they lose, it doesn't bring down your whole world, right? Systemic risk is about the idea that these firms, if they collapse, we might actually have a depression. So we're really over a barrel.
Would you invalidate the contracts?
Well, I think there's a huge hypocrisy in this world. When the help was given to the auto industry, people didn't blink about breaking the contracts that the workers had with the companies. But to break a contract with these high-paid financial folks is somehow sacrosanct. I personally just don't get it.
Why?
So I do think there's a real inequality here, and that is the auto companies had to go through bankruptcy. I actually think that was appropriate that they go through bankruptcy. That was the situation they were in. But some of these banks should have gone through bankruptcy too. And the notion that we have the same management and the shareholders being held harmless when they perform so poorly is at odds with economic common sense. So we really do need to have a system where if they want to have incentive pay – and they do well, they get the upside. But when they do poorly, the negative incentive should be in place as well. And the traditional negative incentives are if you run a bank into bankruptcy, you lose your job and the shareholders don't get their money.
But how about taking the economy down into a tailspin?
We know that the only reason that the taxpayer dollars are in there is not because of any great love for these particular banks or financial institutions. It was the fear of the rest of the economy getting harmed.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, John Harwood, Lawrence Michel, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a caller in Ashland, Oregon. Good morning, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. These discussions that I hear in general about the unemployment rate, they tend to go on to talk about the recovery in the stock market or issues with bonus payments for bankers. But I don't hear discussions about what are the jobs that are going to help the unemployment rate. The building jobs aren't going to come back the way they were before. In the auto industry, in addition to the reductions, there are industries where we worry about global warming, things that in the future are going to harm the economy. So what are the jobs that are actually going to reduce the unemployment rate? And I'll take my answer on the radio.
Thanks for calling.
I think that's a really good question that I hear quite a lot. I think one way to understand what's going on is that we've had a huge loss of wealth in the stock market and housing, and that there's been a huge cutback in consumption by households. And that has ricocheted throughout the economy, and we've lost jobs in every sector. So the jobs we're going to get back are really jobs that are going to be almost across the board. Well, it's basically a matter of when people start spending or we create demand, there's going to be jobs in manufacturing, there's going to be jobs in housing, there's going to be jobs in retail, there's going to be jobs in everywhere. So it's not as if we're looking for some industries to get us out. We have a huge problem where we don't have enough demand for goods and services.
All right, let's take a caller in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the unemployment rate stands at about 15%. Go ahead, Glenn, you're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Couple of observations. I'm currently clearing out my grandparents' and parents' house in southwest Detroit to sell it. And it was a house my grandparents bought in the 1920s. And one thing I noticed as I worked in the house is that every single object in the house, from cooking utensils up to furniture, and everything in between is stamped made in the USA. And none of these things are made in the USA anymore, which is why I think this recession is different from previous recessions in that we no longer really have a manufacturing base in this country, because essentially the rich decided they could get even richer by sending our jobs to China and convincing people that protectionism and tariffs are bad. Well, you know, those things are bad if you're rich, but for the rest of us, protectionism and tariffs, I think, are exactly what we need for the working class. And finally, I heard an economist, Diane, on your show a couple of weeks ago say that he thought it was okay for people to go to big box stores and buy Chinese products because it would create more jobs for Americans to sell those products. And I just think that's one of the most idiotic things I've ever heard an economist say.
Michelle.
Well, I think that this is an underlying story of the economy that helped us get us into this mess and is going to make it hard for us moving forward, is that we have a huge deficit in trade with the world and particularly in China. We have to address that. We are going to need to be able to have a bigger manufacturing sector that's going to export.
Where? What kind of manufacturing jobs?
Well, one of the problems we basically have is that we have an exchange rate problem where China has manipulated the exchange rate. It makes their goods cheaper and our goods more expensive. That is one of the major reasons. It's not just that they have low wages. It's just that actually there's an imbalance in terms of the actual currencies. When we correct that, if we have the guts to correct that, we can actually generate a lot of jobs in manufacturing in this country.
Do you agree with that, Doug?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And one of the things that we're going to see going forward is a real change in the structure of the world economy. The U.S. came into this recession with households having served as the last retail market on the planet. Everybody produced to sell to U.S. households, and U.S. households were able to buy this only by running up a lot of debt. Going forward, households are going to be retrenching. We're not going to see the U.S. as this great retail market. The saving rate's already gone from 0 to about 6%. I'd expect it to go at least to 8, maybe higher. And as a result, other countries are going to have to sell their products to themselves. China's going to have to develop a real domestic economy. The Japanese can't rely on just exports. The Europeans, many of whom
but
do that.
Do you see the United States developing manufacturing sectors of its own?
Yes, we actually have in the past 30 years had tremendous success in manufacturing in the following way. We have the same share of manufacturing total output as we always have. We just have fewer employees there because we've had great productivity growth. We now need to turn that clear advantage into exports, which will power the growth of the economy.
Two things quickly, Diane. First of all, the export-led growth that Doug is describing and the reduction in consumer demand, increase in savings, is exactly the rebalancing of the world economy, the U.S. economy, that Barack Obama is talking about. The second thing that Barack Obama is talking about is building up jobs in the energy sector, and he's laid out a bunch of cash to do that in the stimulus package, and he hopes to take further steps in that climate change bill that Doug thinks is scary, but that Obama and his administration believes is going to stimulate innovation and job growth in the energy sector.
Are you optimistic about what's happening, Larry?
Well, I'm not optimistic about what I see is the terrible pain and hardship that a lot of people are going to be experiencing for several years. I am more optimistic now than a month ago that I think Congress and the administration will take further action to generate jobs. because I think that a month ago they were just saying we will not consider anything. I think now they are considering things to do. And our phone is ringing off the hook from Capitol Hill with people looking for ideas about what to do.
And you, Doug?
I'm optimistic that the economy will grow sluggishly through 2009, but much more rapidly in 2010. And I don't think we need to do additional stimulus steps to get us there.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, he served as chief economist to President George W. Bush. John Harwood, he works for both CNBC and The New York Times. He's co-author with Jerry Seib of Pennsylvania Avenue Profiles in Backroom Power, and Lawrence Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.